Our second reading is from James chapter 4, verse 13 to 5, verse 11, and you can find it on the service sheets. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you've kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Before coming to the Barge 16 years ago, I was an associate minister up in Carlisle, and my study looked out onto a busy main road, and one day I was working away at my desk and I looked up to see a funeral procession driving slowly past, the hearse leading the way, followed by black limousines. And I thought, a funeral. I'm taking a funeral today. Oh, but that's not till 1 o'clock. Got loads of time. Check my watch. 12:50. Ah, that's the funeral I'm taking. A minute later, I was running at full pelt down the street in full clerical gear like the caped Avenger. I got to the church steps just as the hearse turned the corner into the road that the church was on. Cutting it a bit fine, aren't we? Said Joan, the building's manager, waiting at the door with a wry smile. The church already crammed full of people. In aviation terms, that would have gone down as a near miss. Losing track of time can be disastrous, but much more so if we lose track of time spiritually. You see, there are two types of time. The first type of time is the one which is on our clocks, watches, computers, mobiles. What's the time we say? It's 11:20 or whatever on Sunday, the 29th of March, 2020. And we're very aware of time in that sense. Though sometimes, as happened to me that day, we do lose track of it. But there is another type of time which the Bible talks about. For example, in Romans 13, verse 11, it says this. You know the time that the hour has come for you to wake from sleep. The night is far gone, the day is at hand. Time there is being used in a different sense. The night is a picture of this evil age, the day is the coming kingdom. So you know the time means you understand this. You see life from God's perspective. You get where we're at on God's beautiful timeline of salvation history. That we're in the last days between the two comings of the Christ. That Jesus has come, he's going to return soon. Death could come any time. Judgment day lies ahead. Knowing the time means being aware of these realities and living in the light of them. It's possible to have a fancy watch that tells you the time to a fraction of a second, but to not know what time it is in this more important sense, or to lose track of time. And to do that is disastrous. Because losing track of time spiritually means we won't be living as we should. And that's the big concern in this section of James's letter, which I've just read, that we don't lose track of time, that we live in light of God's timeline, that as believers we don't become worldly. The heart of the letter of James is a warning about fake faith. One of the marks of a genuine faith in the Lord, we learn this in 1:27, is to keep oneself unstained by the world. And we looked at one example of this worldliness last week in chapter 4, verses 1 to 12, sinful conflict. And this section now continues the warning not to be worldly. And the key to not falling into that trap is to keep track of time, spiritually speaking. The first time perspective, then, is that life is uncertain, so don't live as if you're in control. That's chapter 4, verses 13 to 15. Look with me at verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. The appeal here is to the businessman or the businesswoman. They've got it all mapped out. Today I'm doing this, tomorrow that. I've got my flight booked to that meeting in Geneva. I'm going to base myself there for a year, set up a new business. Here's the business plan. I should make this much in year one. And we might say, well, what's wrong with that? In business, you've got to make plans. I mean, you can't just live a day at a time. And that's true. The issue here is the attitude. Pride, which we'll get to in verse 16, the leaving God out of the picture, which we'll get to in verse 15. This person is living life without reference to God, as if they are in control. They have the power. If that was a temptation back in the first century, how much more so in the 21st? The tools of modern civilization give us so much power. Our computers and mobiles, our supermarkets and online shopping, next day delivery, global travel, anything we need to know, just a mouse click away, it's all at our fingertips. And there's nothing wrong with that in itself, and it can breed an arrogance, a sense of, I know everything, I can do anything, I'm invincible. And living inside the bubble of our tech-powered civilization, we can feel, I don't need God, I am God. But verse 14 is a wake-up call. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. The power we have blinds us to this reality that actually we're not in control. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. And this global pandemic has woken us all up to that. Yet we're not as powerful as we thought. A bat in a cave somewhere, an invisible microbe, and within weeks the world is in panic and lockdown. And we don't know what tomorrow will bring. What development, what announcement, what restriction. But we never really did. It was just an illusion of power. Verse 14 says, what is your life? One day I'd love to write a book about questions in the Bible. We all have our questions, don't we, that we put to God. Why this, why that? But God has lots of questions himself that he puts to us, and this is one of them. What is your life? It's maybe not something we often stop to think about. What is your life? We think maybe, well, my life's everything. It's secure, it's meaningful, it's mapped out, it's all before me. And God says no. Verse 14, you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Like the morning mist, we're here 1 minute, gone the next. Like a breath on a cold day, like a puff of smoke blown away by the wind. Life is so fragile, so uncertain. You could be dead by next month or tomorrow. And again, we're being forced to face up to this now, aren't we, in a new way. The power we think we have is an illusion. Our lives are like a candle in the wind, one gust, and the flame is out. 20 years ago this summer, my father was working in his study, and my mother went out to the shops. She came back 15 minutes later, and he was dead on the floor. The things that he'd been working on just there on his desk still. The lists of things to do, the preparation for that meeting, the half-written sermon. Like a candle in the wind. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. So what should our attitude be? Look at verse 15. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. We are not in control. God is. And we need to humble ourselves before him and recognize that. Our lives are in his hands. If the Lord wills, you will live tomorrow. Every day, every breath is a gift from him. Every day of our lives is written in his book. as Psalm 139 verse 16 says. And our world is in his hands. Not even a sparrow falls to the ground apart from the will of the Father, Jesus said, Matthew 10:29. And history is moving towards the end that God has determined. He is the one who, as Ephesians 1:11 says, he works all things according to the counsel of his will. We are not in control. We are not pulling the levers of power. We're not in the driving seat. God is. And so we can make plans, but with God at the center. And we make them in pencil, always aware that we are subject to his will. Sometimes older Christians would write the letters DV, which is Latin for Deo Volente, God willing. Or they would say, I'll be there next week, God willing. And perhaps we think it's rather quaint. When the Apostle Paul left Ephesus, he said this, I will return to you if God wills, Acts 18:21. And he wrote to the Romans that somehow, by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you, Romans 1:10. And to the Corinthians he wrote, but I will come to you soon, if the Lord wills, 1 Corinthians 4:19. And I hope to spend some time with you, if the Lord permits, 1 Corinthians 16, verse 7. Now, the point is not that we have to say it after everything. It's about attitude. But if we never say it, that's perhaps revealing. We are to live our lives within this framework. What we are to avoid is the evil pride of verse 16. As it is, verse 16 says, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Living as if we were in charge, we have the power. Such pride, arrogance, boasting, it's evil. God hates it. We saw this last week in verse 6, which said, God opposes the proud. There's a famous poem called Invictus, which ends with the line, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And that's precisely the sort of pride that God is against. In Greek tragedy, they had a word for this. They called it hubris. It means arrogant pride, which led to their downfall. So a biblical perspective on time says, life is uncertain. I could be dead tomorrow. I'm not in control. God is. And so I'm going to live humbly for him. I'm going to go his way, submit myself to him. If we don't do that, we are sinning. Verse 17 says, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. And so if you're going your own way in life at the moment, these verses are a wake-up call. The power you boast of is an illusion. Look at the time. You're not in charge. Your life is a candle in the wind. It's a mist. Submit yourself to God. But these verses are also an appeal to those of us who profess Christian faith to beware having the same worldly attitude, living as functional atheists. It's a mark of fake faith if we're no different to the world around us, living as if we're in charge. We need this perspective on time and this perspective on our lives if we're to live rightly, walking humbly before God. So don't lose track of time. Secondly, judgment is coming, so beware misuse of wealth. This section begins with the same call as the previous one. Come now. Before it is the business person, now it's the wealthy landowner. Come now, you rich. In what sense have these people lost track of time? Well, they've forgotten or ignored that there is a judgment day. Verse 1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. That is to say, coming upon them at the final judgment. Verse 2, your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded. Clothes do get moth-eaten even in this life. Moths have chomped their way through several of my jumpers. But gold and silver, they don't corrode, they don't rust. But they will on judgment day. That's the point. Riches, money, possessions, they may provide security now, but they can't save on judgment day. And in fact, they will testify against people on that day. Verse 3 says, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. So the riches of the rich will be used as evidence against them at the final trial, evidence of their guilt, and condemned they will face the fire of judgment. The rich may have a good life now, but if they had any sense of time, they would weep and howl because of the judgment that is coming. In Isaiah 13:6, it says to Babylon, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. Jesus talked about the great reversal that will take place on that day. In Luke 6, he says, woe to you who are rich. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. The previous section warned about death. But the greater problem is the judgment that lies beyond death. But people have, don't they, a sense of justice, a feeling that one day justice will be done. The Bible confirms that that feeling is in line with reality. We will be called to account. But what in particular will the rich be judged for? So is it sinful to have money? No, it's what we do with it. So the rich here are condemned not for being rich, but for how they misused their riches in two ways. Firstly, for their luxurious living. Look at the end of verse 3. It says, you have laid up treasure in the last days. The Greek word theosurizo, from which we get thesaurus, means to amass treasure, to treasure up, to accumulate wealth, to stockpile not toilet rolls, but money, possessions, the gold and silver of earlier in verse 3. Like the rich man in the parable Jesus told, which was our first reading, with his plans to build even bigger barns to store his goods. And how stupid, verse 3 says, to lay up treasure in the last days, in these days between the two comings of Christ. Verse 5 goes on, you have lived on the earth in luxury and self-indulgence. What's condemned here is not just accumulating wealth, but then spending it on yourself, wasting it on indulging your every desire, spending it on your pleasures, rather than looking to the needs of others. So like the rich man in the parable Jesus told, who ignored the poor man Lazarus, who begged at the gates of his mansion. Verse 5 goes on to say, you have fattened yourselves in a day of slaughter. The irony is that as they indulge themselves, they're just fattening themselves up for the slaughter, their own slaughter, at the judgment. So like a turkey fattening themselves up for Christmas. And again, how stupid to do this when judgment is imminent, rather than putting their money to good use. The second thing the rich are condemned for here is their treatment of the poor. Verse 4, behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. Back then, if you were a worker in the fields, you relied on being paid each day. You needed prompt payment to put food on the table. But the rich landowners were withholding payment. But God hears their cries, and he will come in judgment as the divine warrior. That's what Lord of hosts means, the Lord of the heavenly armies. And then in verse 6, it's apparent that the rich were even taking legal action against the poor. It says, you've condemned, you've murdered the righteous person. He doesn't resist you. We had this back in 2:6 as well, where it said, the rich drag you into court. So taking away the livelihood of the poor was taking away their lives. It was effectively killing them. If this life is all there is, if death is the end, then we might as well get as much money as we can and make our lives as good as we can. But if death is not the end, if there is a judgment, to live like that is folly. Because life is short and eternity is long, and God will call us to account. This time perspective makes all the difference. You see, wealth, like power, deceives us. It gives us a false sense of security. It makes us feel invincible. It gives us the impression that we're the winners, that we've won the game. But it's an illusion because we stand to lose everything. It's striking that this rebel world proudly going its own way, ignoring God, is pictured in the Bible as what? It's pictured as a wealthy, powerful city, as Babylon. Great wealth, great power. But in the last book of the Bible, the cry goes up, Babylon has fallen. Fallen, fallen, it says, is Babylon the Great. The power, the wealth of civilization seems so stable, so secure. But the present-day panic makes us aware, doesn't it, of how fragile the whole system is. It's a castle built on sand, and one day it will collapse. There was a London-based punk band in the late 70s called The Ruts, and their hit single in 1979 was called Babylon's Burning. The chorus says, Babylon's burning with anxiety. Is that not a song for our times? Babylon is burning, and one day it will fall. And we are fools if we invest our hopes in it and live as if the person who dies with the most toys wins. And although the warning in the first place is to the unbeliever, the lesson for those who do profess Christian faith is this. Don't envy the rich who are living for self, and don't aspire to be like them. These people who are held up in the media as having it all, with their crazy salaries and luxury lifestyles and fleets of cars. And beware falling into the same trap. Now, this is a warning we need to take to heart, because in the first century, most of James's readers were poor Christians, and they were being oppressed by the godless rich. But we today are rich Christians, and that gives us great power to do good, but it's also a great danger. A danger that we become worldly in our attitude to money and our use of it. What would you say is the biggest threat to your faith? We hear a lot about sexual immorality, and that is a danger for all of us, and it's a big issue in our culture. I wouldn't want to underestimate that. But what about love of money? Is it even on our radar? It could be that we spend so much time watching the front door, we don't notice that the back door is wide open and the thief has free access. What was the downfall of the city of Sodom? Most of us would probably say sexual immorality, and certainly that was part of it. But listen to Ezekiel 16, verse 49. It says, Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but they did not aid the poor and needy. So what should we do? The first two sections have condemned a wrong perspective, and the final section is a call to God's people to patiently persevere in faith, because the Lord is coming soon. Look at verse 7. It says, Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. As God's people, it says, we are to be patient, and the call to be patient comes up three times, verse 7, verse 8, verse 10. What are we to wait patiently for? Well, verse 7 says, until the coming of the Lord. The Lord is coming soon. Verse 8, the coming of the Lord is at hand. And when he does come, he will bring judgment and salvation. There will be this great reversal. The godless winners in this world will be brought down, and the godly losers in this world will be raised up. So be patient. Like the farmer waiting for the rains that will produce the harvest, waiting patiently, so we're to wait for the coming of the Lord and to keep going in obedient faith. Verse 8 says, establish your hearts. That is, stand firm in faith. Keep living it out. Persevere. Don't become worldly. What is the hope on your horizon? For most people, the hope at the moment is the end of the virus. That's what they're banking on. The day when things will finally return to normal and they can get back to life as it was. But as God's people, the hope dominating our horizon should be the coming of the Lord, not just the end of the virus. We need to beware losing perspective, becoming worldly. As someone has put it, if the New Testament landscape is dominated by the cross of Jesus, the New Testament horizon is dominated by the return of Jesus. So if we know the time, we will be patient and we won't grumble. Verse 9. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. Grumbling is not being patient, and that is especially a temptation when we're under pressure. We become discontent with our lot, we become resentful of others, we criticize, we complain, we grumble against them. Now, it's easy to fall into that, isn't it, at this time of lockdown, to think maybe that others have it so much easier and to grumble against them. So for those who are single, the current isolation has particular challenges. And it's tempting to look at those who are married, I'm sure, and who have kids and think, well, it's all right for them. They're not on their own. And conversely, those who are living with others have particular pressures, with one or both parents now having to work from home, perhaps in a small flat. And they might look enviously at the single person and feel resentful. The grass is always greener over the other side of the fence. But instead of looking over the fence, we need to look at the door. The door at which the Lord is standing on the other side, about to walk through. Verse 9, the judge is standing at the door. We are to live today as if he were coming tomorrow. Familiar scene at school. The teacher leaves the classroom to do something, having set the class work to do. What happens next? Well, everyone starts messing about. But then after a while, a lookout suddenly shouts, "Teacher's coming!" And everyone rushes back to their desks as the footsteps come down the corridor and stop outside the door. And so the judge is at the door. If we're being ungodly, worldly, we need to repent. If you knew the Lord was going to come back tomorrow, would there be some areas of life that you'd sort out today? A wrong relationship you'd give up, an activity you'd stop, a habit you'd break, a sin you'd turn from? The judge is standing at the door. There's no time to lose. And if we want examples to encourage and inspire us to keep going in obedient faith, look to the Old Testament prophets. Verse 10. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. They were ordinary people, but they persevered in faith through difficult times. And think of Job, verse 11. You've heard of the steadfastness of Job. You've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Job lost everything. He lost his children, his business, his health, but he held on to God. And in the end, the Lord was compassionate and merciful to him and restored what he had lost. During this time of global crisis and disruption, some believers will persevere and put down even deeper roots in Christ, and they will come out of this stronger. But others will drift away spiritually. And when the dust has settled, they'll be nowhere to be seen, having thrown in their lot with the world. Which we end up being will depend on, in part, on whether we keep an eye on the time or lose track of time. What time is it? We've seen that life is uncertain and fragile. So let's walk humbly before the Lord each day. We've seen that judgment is coming. So let's not hoard money, not just spend it on ourselves, but be generous and give and use it to do good. We've seen that the Lord's return is near. Let's keep going patiently in obedient faith, not becoming worldly and grumbling, but loving. Lord Shaftesbury was the great English social reformer of the 19th century. He was born into privilege. So his background was one of horses and shooting parties and waltzing in stately homes. He was an aristocrat. But he became a Christian, and he dedicated his life to serving the poor, the oppressed, and the exploited, and to advancing the cause of foreign missions. He was often opposed. Why did he do that? Why did he do that when he could have just continued in a life of ease and self-indulgence? Well, he was reported to have said this on one occasion. He said, "I do not think that in the last 40 years I've ever lived one conscious hour that was not influenced by the thought of our Lord's return." He knew the time, and it made all the difference. By contrast, I was reading the blog of a couple called William and Catherine who were on the trip of a lifetime sailing around the world. This is how one entry begins. Ship's log. Oh, my goodness. We've lost track of time. When it happened, I've no idea. Each day rolls into the next. And where are we? Well, that's fine if you're on a sailing holiday. But spiritually, that is a very dangerous condition to be in, to lose track of time. For each day to roll into the next, to not know where you are, spiritually, that spells disaster. So may we be those who keep an eye on the time from God's perspective and whose lives are shaped by it.